close enough.
Okay.
All right, good evening. Joshua chapter 1. Do a couple things, then we'll turn on to chapter 2 tonight and actually start leave the prologue behind and actually start doing some of the story. Let's start with a word of prayer. Can someone lead us in that tonight? Do that? Going once, going twice. Am I being volunteered? Oh, Scott! Next week.
Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time we have to come together and study your word and learn what you would have us to know. We pray that you be with the teacher and us as students, that we may gain everything we can from your word and the examples within it. Please be with many of our number who are ill and need your help and hands administered to them. Please bring them back to us and keep them safe. Be with those on the road. And be with our families and loved ones. We thank you above all things for your son Jesus. In his name we pray.
All right, so the first couple of weeks we've kind of been both setting up the book of Joshua within the larger canon of the Bible, and then last week talking a little bit more about kind of some connections, especially between Deuteronomy and Joshua, especially Joshua chapter 1. A lot of God's language echoes, if not phrases, certainly concepts that God had given to Moses and Joshua, and of course Joshua's being raised up as Joshua's successor. We also looked a little bit last week at just kind of Joshua in the Pentateuch, right? The first five books there with Moses. And he's been with Moses since basically the Red Sea, right? I mean, he was, you know, started as the intern and worked his way up. I don't know. But, you know, we first meet him there, like, literally right after the sea when Moses needs his hands held up as they are fighting the Amalekites. And he's been there all the way through. He's one of the faithful spies. He was with Moses on the mountain. Just you know, really kind of groomed from the beginning, almost it seems, providentially for the role before God officially acknowledged him as Moses' successor later in the book of Numbers, as after it was clear that Moses would not enter the land. So just a couple more things to notice from chapter 1, that prologue. First of all, do look at the charge that God gives to Joshua there. I mean, it starts with kind of some imperatives in verse 2, arise and go over. You know, that's the basic mission. That's what's going to kick in chapter 2. But the internal preparation for Joshua to carry out these two actions, you know, especially there in verses 6 through 9, three times or so, God says Joshua be strong and courageous. And again, that's language from the Pentateuch. We saw that last week as we were kind of, you know, spot checking around a few places. This language would be strong and courageous. And so three times, God reiterates that to Joshua. We forget these are real people. You know, we just sit there and we read, you know, Hebrews 11, all these great people of faith, and, you know, just, you know, it takes you 30 seconds to read that. These were days, months, years, sometimes decades of their lives wrestling with God, you know, struggling to faith. You know, they're real people. And so even though Joshua has been everywhere from the sea to the mountain to the land already, I mean, we stop and think about it. He's literally one of the only ones along with Caleb who's been in the land and back. And yet still, when the moment finally comes, God has to, you know, pile on that be strong and courageous. Other things to notice, especially in verses 6 through 9, of that internal motivation that God gives Joshua. He'll remind you, for you shall cause, verse 6, this people to inherit the land that they swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law, that's Torah, that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or left, that you may have good success. And that language actually parallels kind of wisdom. And that's interesting because Deuteronomy chapter 4 links the law, Torah, and wisdom. When you keep the law, the peoples who watch Israel living this holy, structured, God-fearing life, if they actually kept the law, would say what wisdom there is among these people. And so that this link between the law leads to wisdom. It's an interesting word that's used there, the classic translation success, partially because in Hebrew, words communicate through analogies. It's a vocabulary poor language, so there's a lot of analogy in there. And so the whole idea is when you tend to live wisely, you tend to also be successful, right? You know, the great investor is the guy who knows how to read the signs of the times and invest. You know, either buy or sell at the right time, short of insider trading. But right, that's you know, some guy's got a knack for that. Warren Buffett knows how to evaluate a company and get in when the getting in's good. He just, you know, he is, his wisdom in that area has led to great success. That's the fundamental concept. The law makes wise. And you know, you think about meditations on the law in the book of Psalms that say things like that, right? Psalm 19, you know, right? You know, making wise the simple. Remember that? Okay, so fundamental concept actually starts in Deuteronomy. That the world will look at this law, they will look at Israel and say, what wisdom among these people. Tell us about your God. Life works for you people. Why? This is why. And so focus on the law. Verse 8, including that, again, it's interesting. You know, God says he's going to do his part. I promised the land's going to happen. What's your part? Keep the law. So much so, verse 8, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but in this law you shall meditate day and night. And that word meditate, we kind of hear that as kind of, you know, maybe a little bit of kumbaya or sitting there, you know, right cross-legged, hands on knees. Part of the what's going on here in Hebrew, it shall not depart from your mouth, but you will meditate on it. That word in Hebrew for meditation actually means to murmur. You ever get so deeply lost in thought about something that you start talking to yourself and you don't realize it, and somebody comes in the room, sometimes like, you know, what'd you say? Or who you talking to? You ever been there? I do it more often than I care to admit. But I tend to be a little bit absent-minded and lost in my own head a lot. That's the image here. You are so constantly, day and night, meditating upon God's law, that becomes a murmuring in your mouth. You know, what'd you say? You talking to somebody? You're literally just talking to yourself about the law. It's just so, you're so thoroughly lost in constant reflection, meditation upon God's law. Does that make sense? Which is really something to think about in a day and age where we do our Bible reading for the day or for the week, if we're keeping up with what the church is doing. Maybe we have our 15-minute morning devotional time. And then we will spend 3 hours of the course of the day scrolling on our phones instead. And the truth of the matter is that this level of constant reflection upon the Word of God, and yet God's not literally saying you can't go to work, focus on what you're doing, do a good job. When you're driving, keep full focus on the road, 10 and 2, right? But the idea is that, you know, the empty space in our minds is not to be occupied by the trivialities. That's so often exactly what we do. Let's be honest. When, you know, I do it too, no. But, you know, what's the temptation when you're in the checkout line at the grocery store? Right? All sorts of filling the empty space with trivialities. And yet God says to Joshua, the wise, the wisdom and success that you're looking for comes through this day and night. This is the default conversation you fall back to. Not, the default is not your phone. The default is not social media. The default is not calling somebody because I'm bored. The default is fall back to thinking about God and meditating upon his words. Does that make sense? It's a really powerful image, verse 8. Maybe those words are familiar. That was actually, when I was growing up, I still remember to this day, when I was a kid, that was actually one of the memory verses growing up. And that's why I'm determined to get it right now. I know that. I've tried to get this right for decades. This is the one. Finally get it. But it's a powerful thing. And then last thing to notice, verse 9, have I not commanded you? And again, that's interesting. This is not a pep talk. This is not a TED talk. This is not a motivational speaker helping you have your miracle Monday morning minute. This is actually a command. God's people are commanded to be strong and courageous. And you'll notice verse 9, this is really important because we don't think about it this way. What, if you're not strong and courageous, what are you? What does verse 9 say? If you're not strong and courageous, what are you?
Afraid.
You're afraid. The great opposite of faith is not faithlessness as we tend to think of it. The great opposite of faith is fear. Fear is its own form of faithlessness. What's the most common command in the Bible, Old and New Testaments? Don't be afraid. Because that's the real acid of faith. Not some sort of intellectual evolution is going to convince me. You know, I think sometimes the reason people buy into that is because it's actually more fearful, in a sense, to face the living God. Contemplate the enormity of, until you're actually ready to die, there is a little bit of a soft comfort in there being no moral meaning to life, so I don't have to worry about my porn habit, my drinking habit, my, you know, whatever else is going on, right? Until the moment of death comes and all I have is the abyss. But there is a certain cold comfort for a season, especially when we're younger, middle-aged, and don't have to think about our mortality quite as intensely, with there not being an account, you know, not being a judgment day. And so, you know, there is a sense of which, you know, just think about when people did encounter God in the Bible. It was awesome. I loved it. I've been waiting for this. Is that what happened?
They were afraid.
The God who's a consuming fire. That's, by the way, why I've learned over the years in doing what I do. When somebody tells me they've seen an angel or God spoke to them or came to them in a dream, whatever, I know it's not true. Because whenever people tell me that, they're actually relieved or comforted or telling me how great it was. And I'm thinking, that again. Then you didn't see an angel. You saw him working.
There's no PTSD behind it.
That's exactly. There is no PTSD behind what just happened. Yeah, that's exactly right. Because in the Bible, even the mere angel terrified people, right? Remember Samson's parents, when they find out they're going to have a baby? They're, you know, they've been waiting on the baby, haven't been able to have a baby. Think it'd be good news they're going to have a baby. Instead, they're terrified. We're dead. We just saw God. isn't that funny? So, yeah, I mean, there is a certain terror, paradoxically, in having to contemplate and the presence of God. So, yeah, there it is. The opposite, you know, the real issue is fearfulness. And it's actually because we live in an age of extreme fearfulness. We have softer words for it. Sometimes we call it anxiety. Sometimes, you know, some other words that we use for it. Jesus, don't worry, right? Don't worry about tomorrow. I mean, just we tend to be fearful creatures. So anyways, that's a longer conversation for another time. But just notice this. The real danger here is not they're going to stop believing in God. The real danger is they're going to be afraid. What happened in Numbers 13 and 14, the first time that spies were sent out? What happened? They were afraid. And they died because of it. Was he going to set up another idol? Isn't it interesting? God doesn't kick them out of the land or refuse to give them land for their idolatry, the golden calf. When does he say, you don't get the land? You're too afraid.
Which means the lack of faith.
Which is ultimately, that's right. That's right. And that's why it's interesting in Revelation 21 and verse 8. List of those who are in the lake of fire. The first in the list is not the homosexuals, it's not the adulterers, it's not, you know, the murderers, you know, all kind of, you know, our hierarchy of sins that we keep. It's the cowardly. And this is part of what Revelation is all about, writing the Christians, like, don't you chicken out on your commitment to faith because of the world's pushback and persecution. The cowardly are first in line. That's another word for the fearful. All right, enough of that to turn into a little bit more of a rant, sorry. Don't be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. That's the ultimate article of faith right there that you hold on to. And by the way, it doesn't mean that we don't ever feel afraid. But what the Bible always reminds us is you are not your emotions. The world tells you you are your emotions. That's how you're true to yourself. The Bible says your will and your intellect can absolutely beat your emotions into submission. So you may feel afraid. We all do at times. What's the response in those fearful moments? That's the real me? No. What do we remind ourselves? The Lord is with you wherever you go, even when it doesn't look like it. That's the dance we do in our heads and our hearts. Okay. Anyway, want to end on that real quick before we do one last thing in chapter one and then move on?
The people who are facing, like the guys in the army, the heroes will tell you it wasn't my lack
of right. Yeah.
fear,
yeah.
but my knowing that I am doing this,
yeah.
that I have cause, that I have camaraderie.
Yeah.
Well,
and part of this is, you know, do a class on fear, what fear really is. Sometime, maybe that'd be the first quarter. They'll go, you know, I didn't know whether I was going to live or die, sometimes they'll say, because that's not the issue. And that's part of what makes us fearful is too much of a focus on self. They ultimately, it's not because they, you know, again, they still have a self. They know they could die, and there is a moment of, you know, perhaps hesitation or fearfulness. But once they push to the side and get to the moment, whether it's a military guy, a first responder, whoever, whenever they're in that moment, like, they're literally living for others. You know, whether it's pulling their wounded brother out of the crossfire in a battle, whether it's the firefighter running into the burning building, whether it's a police officer shooting back at an active shooting, you know, whatever. They ultimately push their sense of self out, and they're living for others. And that's what the Bible always comes back to, actually. That's that whole death to self. The world tells us to find ourselves. The Bible says actually you're going to be a whole lot happier and healthier if you'll die to yourself. So that'd be another class for the recording. All right, last bit.
I'll take note of that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Scott.
No, I'll take note.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Wrong deacons in the room right now. Yikes. We don't have to finish that conversation about next year anyways, did we? Okay. So for sake of time, I really want to get into chapter 2, and I'm already halfway through tonight. One of the things that happens in chapter 1 really is a prologue, besides this really significant kind of giving Joshua how this all really works and what the real issues are, is you have in various points throughout the chapter really what are kind of the basic themes of the book as a whole brought up in some way, shape, or form when you stop thinking about the things that the book is going to cover. And, you know, the book is going to be all about, we'll call it holy war, you know, because Deuteronomy, and we'll look at Deuteronomy in some applicable points as we go back and we look at the stories of some of their battles and how they took the land and how Deuteronomy was either obeyed or disobeyed. But the point is, this whole issue of how they conduct battle, this holy war, holy in the sense of, not in the crusade sense, holy in the sense of God had given them actually a blueprint in Deuteronomy for how you do this. How you fight battles, how you conquer, what you do with peoples. Deuteronomy, the law, had spoken to this. And so that's part of why these stories, it's not about whether God can do it, it's about whether the people will do what they're supposed to do as they handle their end of the business. The theme of the land, I mean, it's already mentioned there in verses 3 and 4, again in verse 15, the issue of the land, that finally the promises to Abraham and the patriarchs are being kept. They are getting the land. One of the other interesting things, and this is, we're going to take time in class to go look at verses 12 through 16, but the issue of the unity of the people. The issue of the unity of the people, that Israel needs to be unified in one. That's already been an issue because in the book of Numbers, remember, right, 2.5 tribes want to stay on the other side. This is good enough. And there's a moment of tension in which Moses is afraid that this is a repeat of Kadesh Barnea. But this is also going to be an issue. And this is why there's going to be some of the rituals, the stacking of stones, when they come across the Jordan that we've read about, if you're doing the weekly reading right now, the Mount Ebal and Gerizim. It's going to be active rituals of national unity through the book. But ultimately, is this, when we talk about Joshua's place in the canon, especially when we talk about how Deuteronomy, the Deuteronomistic history, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings. Is the unity of the people and the land going to actually become an issue as the history continues to unfold? And the correct answer is, and the irony is, just like you see the pattern in the conquest, especially ironically where we're at right now, even this very week in chapter 11, if you're reading this week, the pattern of a southern section of the land versus a northern section, is that actually going to become an issue as time goes on? A north-south split? Yeah, it is. And so again, Joshua, and we talked about this last week a little bit, four books in this historical sequence in the Hebrew canon, reflecting the values of Deuteronomy, the faithfulness of God, the disobedience of the people that lead to exile. Joshua, all's good. Judges, it falls apart. Samuel, David comes, it's good. Kings, it all falls apart, right? 2 and 2 patterns, that's going to be part of the thing is Joshua, it all works and they're unified. Judges, are they disunified in Judges? Yeah, in fact, before Judges is over, they have a flat-out civil war, and the tribe of Benjamin is nearly annihilated. So, this constant struggle. And by the way, does that, by analogy, translate to the struggle to maintain unity among God's people in the church? Of course it does. Those of us who are over a certain age have probably either been around a troubled congregation at some point of our lives. God forbid, maybe even been part of a church split one way or the other. If you've lived long, if you've seen trouble in the congregation, right? It's a theme that literally works out through geography in the Old Testament, but it becomes a constant spiritual story. You think about Paul's teachings in the New Testament to some of those churches, right? Corinthians, come on, guys. Corinthians, I hear about the divisions among them. Constant struggle. Maintaining the unity of the people of God. Role of Joshua, we've talked a lot about. The concept of the covenant and the law. The importance, the high importance of the covenant and the law. So, all right, it's enough of that. Chapter 2. We meet Rahab. But thinking through the book holistically, here's the important thing about this part of the story. We meet Rahab, and we can talk about Rahab a little bit, but it's a repeat. Patterns. There's going to be a lot of patterns between the first generation and the second generation. And what's the pattern here? You have another spying out of the land before they go in. So step 1. you know, we're so used to thinking about Rahab and Jericho, yes, but the actual fall of Jericho is on the literally on the other side of the river. That's several chapters away. This, we meet Rahab in the context of spies sent out. Does that ring a bell? Is that a dangerous time? And we don't think about it that way because we don't realize, you know, if you're reading this honestly, that should scare you a little bit, right? Now, what's interesting is, you know, the kind of patterns that we see to begin to emerge out of Joshua chapter 2 about this kind of thing. How many spies are sent?
Two.
How many faithful spies were there last time?
Two.
Who sends them out?
Joshua.
One of those faithful spies. Isn't that interesting? Joshua's learned two is more. but two faithful spies, one of those surviving spies, sends two out. This happens before they cross in the land. And what's interesting is when you get to the end of the chapter and they do make it back to Joshua, and in fact, stop, you can look at verse 24, but before we look at it and read it, was it dangerous for them in the land? Did they still encounter dangers in the land? Did the spies encounter dangers in the land?
Yes.
Yes. Were they having to be hid?
Yes.
Yes. So is it still kind of like Numbers 13 when the spies go out to sea and realize there are giants here and they have powerful cities and we should be intimidated by this? Is it still, in other words, the same kind of, if you want to be afraid and you want to see the danger, you can see it? If you ever get to go to Israel, Jericho's barely across the Jordan. You can see it from the far side of the Jordan. And so it's like literally, so much for spying out the land, we can't even get past Jericho without, this got really dangerous really quick. We're having to hide in piles of flax to avoid being caught. And yet, verse 24, this time, these two spies, like the previous two faithful spies, come back and what do they say to Joshua in verse 24? What do they say?
Truly the Lord has delivered all the land into our hands.
Yeah. A very different outcome this time. Despite the danger, the risk, they literally have to run, right? I mean, I don't know if you caught that part of the story, if you read chapter 2. Literally, what they have to do, Jericho's right here, Israel's over here. So they go across, my maps, I know some of you want to laugh right now. Jericho's here. What Rahab has them do, you know, if you read the story, right, when Rahab says they've left, and I don't know where they are, and so the king's men who are looking for them, they go back to the fords of the river thinking they were trying to escape. Rahab has, and you can literally see hills from Jericho. I mean, literally, you go about a mile, I'm a bad guesstimating distances. 1 or 2 miles, you've seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that fair?
A couple miles.
Yeah, not far. Giant hills, full of caves. Rahab tells them, run over there. And for 3 days, that's an interesting number. 3 is always an interesting number in the Bible. For 3 days, they hide out, and then they go back. They have risked their necks to do this. And yet, what do they say in verse 24 without hesitation? Truly, the Lord. You know. Now, I know God's with us, but boy, that was close. They come back and say, no doubt, we got this. God's got this, more importantly. God's got this. Very different and very powerful story. You got to read chapter 2 in light of the book of Numbers and the parallels there, all right? Because that's often and easily forgotten. All right.
I feel like, Jeff, if that had been me, I'd come back. Let me tell you about the adventure I just
had. Exactly. Yeah. It's all good, but. That's exactly right. Or these days, man, with GPS tracking, why'd you guys go over here and there? What are you guys doing? Taking selfies? No. All right. So let's look at the story a little bit. Look at the story. Verses 1 and 2. What's the irony or the humor here? Now look at the words. Sorry, how verse 1 begins and how verse 2 plays out. What's the irony or the humor there? I mean, it just says more about me, that there's irony or humor here.
Why would they ever go to the house of a prostitute?
Okay, well, that's a fair question. Answer. Because in the ancient world, there weren't hotels, and so ironically, I mean, part of why prostitutes kind of doubled as hotels was traveler. I mean, same thing today, where the stereotype of the businessman out of town.
Plus, if they see a stranger go in there, they may not pay any attention to
it. Well, that's part of it. That's also just where there is nowhere to go. There is nowhere to stay, and so, but as long as you're there, it's a full-service hotel. I mean, that's how that worked in the ancient world. That's why, by the way, sidebar, it was that way for centuries. A Holiday Inn does not come along until the 20th century. Well, yeah. And so, And so that's why in the early church, showing hospitality was so important. We think about hospitality, and I have people over for game night, and that's fine, I'm not knocking that. But in the Bible, hospitality was, and you go back and read like 2 John about this, it was about keeping traveling evangelists and traveling Christians from trying to, you know, you don't want to sleep out in the open because what happened in the open? Stuff, right? And there's no, you know, FBI, there's no crime scene CSI, whatever, to figure out who'd done it and protect you, right? It was really easy to murder somebody if you wanted to murder somebody and get away with it, okay? So you didn't just recklessly sleep out or sleep, you know, whatever. What happened to the, you know, what happened to the angels back in the story of Sodom when they're just, you know, we'll sleep out there. What does Lot say?
Lot,
don't do
your
that.
House, right?
Yeah, come to my house. If nobody else take you in, come to my house. Because that's the ancient world for centuries. We have no idea how much the world has changed in the past 300 years.
We'll see it again in Judges.
Correct. Same issue. So anyways, yeah. So it is a great cover, but it's also just what you do when you're out of town. You don't know where you're. Even if you're not looking for that, that's just where you stay. But that's again why the apostles are telling early Christians, man, look out for each other. If somebody's traveling through, don't make them find a place to sleep. If you got a house, share it. So that was the original concept of the love of the stranger, which is what xenophilia, hospitality, actually means. That's the whole point. You don't know these guys, but they need a place to stay better than all their other options. Help them out. Yeah.
I think what you might find funny is my guess is, I don't think they come across as really good spies up front.
Correct, yeah. Because what's the adverb in verse 1? Joshua sends them
secretly,
and yet by verse 2,
King of Jericho knows.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of a, yeah, to your point. They're not very good at this thing. But think about it from another angle. Certainly there is a bit of irony. Because again, remember, the Bible does not, the Bible is very economical in its words. Right? We talk about this all the time. So if something's there, why is it secretly versus the king immediately knows? Okay, so much for secretly. But in the Bible, what does that usually mean? That, you know, we can certainly kind of chuckle and smile a little bit about that. But what does that also show?
God's hand is in it.
That's it. This should not work. This should end badly for these two guys. And yet, it does not. Why? Is that right? And it goes back to, and we want to treat Rahab. You know, Rahab's very familiar. She's a prostitute. You know, text makes no ambiguity about it. She is a prostitute, and a lady of ill repute. And so she's got stories, she's got a past, she's got baggage. And yet, in God's providence, think about this. Rahab fits a little bit of the pattern that we'll see. We're more familiar from the New Testament side, right? But she fits a little bit of the pattern of the seeking Gentile who doesn't know well but is open when the moment comes. What does God say to Peter about Cornelius, dirty, filthy Gentile Cornelius who eats pigs? What does God say to him when Peter says, I don't want to go to that guy? Oh, and he's a Roman centurion. That's also bad if you're a Jew. Yeah. I know this guy's heart. I know what he's about, and he's looking for me, and you're the guy to go close the deal. He's a God-fearer. He's praying. What, Rahab is a God-fearer. What does she say to the spies? And she brings it up.
We've seen what you do. We know about your God.
Yeah. I already fear your God. I just have an opportunity to confess it or do something about it yet. Right? She's a Gentile who's fearing God. She's a God-fearing Gentile. Look, there's not a whole lot in the Bible. This is the book of Joshua. There's not a whole lot in the Bible yet that's been revealed to confess about God. But what there is already, she can basically run from Exodus to Numbers, and she's got the story down, and she's confessing it. That's as good as you can do at this point in Revelation and in the history of God's work in history. And she's confessing all of it. Okay? She is a righteous Gentile. She doesn't know everything she needs to know. She's got stories to tell, but she's seen the mighty acts of God, and she's been moved to faith and confession. And she confesses well. And again, you know, irony of irony, she shows more faith than the first generation that came out of Exodus. In the Exodus. And so, yes, you've got a Rahab here, and that's why Matthew, you know, she's in Jesus' genealogy. That's why in Hebrews she's held out as an exemplar of faith. That's why James holds her up in chapter 2, faith without works is dead. Not because she has a perfect understanding, but the whole point is she has a faith that leads to action in the right direction. We can throw rocks, she lies, she does some things she ought not to do, yes. But she has a faith that's moving in the right direction, consistent with what she knows at the time. And God says, I can work with that. And again, just like the providence of God getting Peter to Cornelius, or Philip to the eunuch, right, there is a pattern here of God getting his people to providentially the God-fearing person. And this is one of the early instances of that in the Bible. It's a powerful moment. She says all the right things, and she is the right kind of person.
Death was at her door. The king came to her door.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
her life.
And we know from ancient law, you know, pagan law codes that we have for archaeology and whatnot, what she was doing would have gotten her killed if she'd been caught.
Sure.
Yeah.
She knew that.
And the other thing you got to understand, too, is she has a house on the wall. You think that sounds cool. That's where the poor people lived back then. This was not River Oaks in Jericho. You live there. Because here's what you understand. If you have a house on the wall, here's how that really works. That sounds really cool to understand what it means to have a house on the wall. Space, especially in ancient cities, is much smaller. Ancient cities are measured in acres, not zip codes. And so space is at a premium, and so you use every bit of space. If you live in a wall, the idea is you've got one side of the wall, you know, the city wall, and another side of the wall. The hollow space in between, what they would do is they would use that for living space, but it means if y'all got invaded and the city needed to be refortified at the time of invasion, they filled your house with dirt to strengthen the wall. It was a place of first line eminent domain. You didn't want to live in a wall because when push came to shove, they filled your house with rubble to fortify the wall. In the meantime, living space, sure, why not? But your house is public property, you live in a wall. It's not the place you want to live. She's vulnerable on so many levels, is her problem. And yet, especially, you know, verses 9 through 14, this staggering articulation of faith such as she could have at that time, right? But here's where it gets interesting. Just like we sometimes talk about the book of Acts, the pattern, you got Cornelius. And the pattern of Cornelius' conversion very much tracks with the original gospel going to the Jews. We sometimes call Acts chapter 10 the Gentile Pentecost, right? It's still Peter. He preaches the gospel. The Spirit comes down as a sign, not that people are already saved, but a sign that this is God's doing, this is the moment. And you know, ironically, the Spirit comes down as much for Peter's benefits. The Spirit's come down upon them as upon us at the beginning. You know, was baptized. Absolutely, okay. And so it's a repetition of Pentecost, but for the Gentiles. This is the Gentile Passover. Same kind of situation. What's about to happen? A body of water is about to part. People are about to come. Death is at hand. Egypt was under the curse of death. Jericho is under the curse of death, and only those who are spared are those who have some sort of God-ordained, God-acceptable symbol mark upon their dwelling. But what are they told? What is when she asks the spies, I have shown you chesed, in Hebrew, that's the only we use that word all the time. When she says, I've dealt with you kindly, I've shown you chesed. I've shown you a level of loyalty above and beyond what we would otherwise have. I would like chesed from you and your God in return. They say, absolutely, we'll make an oath to that end. You do this, just like with the Passover. If any Jewish person, because they're Jewish, if any Jewish person not put the blood on the doorpost, what would happen? They make very clear to her, read the second half of the chapter. We are guiltless if you don't do this. We are guiltless if you leave the protected house. You know, we've all seen that scene in Charlton Heston's Ten Commandments. Coming up here in a couple weeks if you haven't, get ready to watch it. When the creepy green cloud, which was cutting edge, special effects at the time, is going by. Remember that dramatic suspense when Joshua decides to run across the street as a, I love that moment. I remember as a kid, is he going to make it?
I don't know. Let's watch.
We've had 70 years.
Last
to figure
year,
this out.
He made it, but I don't know if he's going to make it this year.
I'm just
going to read the book.
I do prefer the book. I do recommend the book. That's exactly right. But it's, but there is that sense of he's in danger because he's outside the house. They got that right. Just because you're Jewish doesn't give you get out of jail free card on this.
He wasn't under the
Say again?
He wasn't under the
book. Correct. And so hang the scarlet cord from your window. And again, very clear, whoever's going to be saved has to be
in
the house. And if they leave the house,
blood's not on our hands.
Not our problem. We and our God will show you chesed. as you've shown us, and then really by showing us, showing God loyal, a level of loyalty. I fear your God more than I fear my king. And so it is a Gentile form of Passover. And they are protected as long as they follow the God-ordained symbol for their house.
Yeah.
Yes. During that time, weren't there people who declined to have the blood put on their doorposts and we don't want it?
I think that was more Cecil B. DeMille. I do remember, there is a scene in the Ten Commandments about that when Dathan, who somehow jumps from Numbers to Exodus, I've seen that movie way too many times. Joshua goes to, he's trying to save his life. No, the Bible, I don't recall anybody refusing the blood in the Bible, which is the official version. I'm open to correction on that, but I know of no examples of that. The other thing that's interesting to think about is, and again, this is something the Jews, and you can turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 4, because this is a Deuteronomy moment. I've actually already alluded to this tonight, but let's just see it again with our own eyes. Deuteronomy chapter 4. But, with the inclusion of Rahab as basically one of the people of God, not by birth, but by faith, and this Gentile recapitulation of the Passover ritual, where the death that's coming will pass over her and her house. The Bible has always made clear that the election of the Jews was not to the ultimate exclusion of the Gentiles, not just in the church in the New Testament, but even back then. Exodus chapter 12, they left a mixed multitude from Egypt. There were those who had enough faith or enough fear or whatever to leave Egypt with ethnic Israel. It was always that way from the beginning. And again, Moses says in Deuteronomy chapter 4, and I'm going to start in verse 5. See, I have taught you statutes and rules as the Lord my God commanded me that you should do them in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. Keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of all the peoples who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as Yahweh our God is to us whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that they set before you today? That was the whole point. They were the original city set on the hill. Right? And so Rahab's a perfect example of that. What is Rahab saying? I've seen the light that I want in. It was always their righteous keeping of the law was always meant to be a door for the Gentiles to come to know God. And so you think about passages like in Micah or Isaiah chapter 2, in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established above all mountains. We write into that as the church, right? When ironically, literally on the mountain of God, which was the temple mount, Peter preaches that first sermon. And the whole point is in the description of the book of Acts, the nations were there that day. But literally, that Isaiah 2 and related Micah prophecy really, in a sense, was just a fulfillment of, going back to Deuteronomy, what Israel was always supposed to be. It's just ultimately the Israel that will do this and keep this. It's not the Israel of the flesh, it's the Israel of the spirit. But this was always the idea that the people of God would be a light to the world for those who were looking for. And so Joshua chapter 2 with Rahab is really just an early example of this fundamental reality, which means evangelism matters, it means righteous living matters, it means 1 Peter 3, always be ready to give an answer, matters. God has always been about, the best form of evangelism is not hire a better preacher. The best form of evangelism is the life that you live. The song that we used to sing a little bit more, the world's Bible, some of y'all remember that song, Christ has no hands but our hands. We are the world's Bible, not just by what we say, but literally how we live. Our job is to make God look good. So, all right, somebody want in on that before the second bell catches us in about 60 seconds?
Jeff, you were talking about cowardice earlier. Kevin Clark gave a great lesson on this, and it's on the website. So if you go to the website and search for coward, you'll find a great lesson on the topic.
Coward, Kevin Clark. That's awkward, but okay. No, that's it. point taken. Yeah, thank you for that. Kevin's great. Anybody else?
You made me think of 1 Peter 2:9, that you're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who calls you out of his
darkness. Exactly. The Bible's just 20 big ideas, just repeated over and over again in various forms. that's another example of this is always what God's wanted. He creates a people, and the point of his people is to proclaim his excellencies to the world through our living. Whether it's the Deuteronomy 4 version, the 1 Peter 2 version, or everything in between. That's exactly right. All right, save the bill.
Isn't it ironic that